Hey, Prime members, you can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hey, Coach, I heard a pop. You know, I think he's hurt pretty bad.
You get out of here. Y'all wouldn't know anything about dedication, team play.
But I would. Don't do it, Wendell. It's not worth it, man.
You gonna listen to that from a gimp who's praying that we're loose so he can be the missing link?
Maybe I shouldn't do it.
Get the hell out of here.
Don't do it.
Don't I lose my temper. Get up!
Don't do it, Wendell. Get out. If that needle goes anywhere near Wendell's leg, I swear to God on my mother's grave, I will rip your arms off and beat you to death with them.
John has a gap in his teeth, so he wore these fake front teeth. The teeth made him look intimidating. What was not intimidating was when he got really fired up and the teeth would fly out of his mouth. You just kind of remind yourself, that's right, they're fake teeth. He's not really that scary. You can do this.
Hi, I'm Dan Patrick, and this is IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick, an Amazon original, the podcast where I talk to some of Hollywood's top actors, directors, and producers about some of their most iconic scenes that have defined their careers, helped shape the cinematic landscape, and have even become fixtures in pop culture. On today's show, we're joined by the actor James Vanderbeek. James was born in Cheshire, Connecticut in 1977. And in 1993, at the age of 16, he began acting in off-Broadway plays in New York City. His meteoric rise continued in 1998 when he was cast as Dawson Leary in the hit TV show Dawson's Creek. This led him to being cast as the lead character, Jonathan Mox Moxon, in the 1999 film Varsity Blues. Varsity Blues was directed by Brian Robbins and also starred John Voight, Amy Smart, Paul Walker, Ali Larter, and Scott Kahn. The movie was a smash hit at the box office, earning just over $54 million off a $16 million budget. Today, we are discussing the climactic scene where Mox and the team finally confront Coach Bud Kilmer, and where Mox makes the hero speech to rally the team together. What was it about high school football?
I had played football growing up. I played baseball. My father had been a minor league baseball player before I was born. So sports and athletics, team sports especially, always spoke to me. I think it was the idea of a guy who was in a position where authority was just wrong. And he was standing up to grownups who were wrong. And that just really lit my fire. I knew what it was like to be in a huddle. I knew what it was like to look at all those other eyeballs and realize we all have the same goal, no matter what our differences might be. And I just found that exciting.
You're there with the team. You then confront Coach Kilmer, and then he comes out and he chokes you. Mm-hmm. Out of those three, which one was the toughest to nail?
Confronting him first. Made more complicated by the fact that Eli Swinton, who was playing Wendell, had played college at, I think, Stanford. And he was sitting there on the table and he was looking kind of down. I was like, "You good?" He goes, "Yeah, man, it's just weird because I actually played this scene in real life and I took the shot and it ended my career."
Oh.
Yeah. It felt real. And it was the first time I'd ever really directly confronted Kilmer. So it was the first time I'd ever gotten to see the beast come out. And Voight's definitely got he's got access to that beast when he wants to turn it on and focus it on you. He is scary. He is intimidating when he wants to be.
You about ready to lose that scholarship, boy?
If he keeps that needle out of his leg, absolutely.
Good.
F*** it, I'm out.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Finally. Twitter, you take the snaps.
No, I won't. No, I'm out, Coach.
What'd you say?
I said I'm out.
I'm with them.
Only way we're going back out in the fields without you.
This is pretty heady stuff for somebody who's 20, 21 years of age. Now, you have Dawson's Creek at the time. Mm-hmm. How are you handling this that you're leading a movie here?
It was crazy. It was my first lead in a movie. I'd started out doing theater when I was 16 years old in New York City. I had done one other movie before that, one other big studio movie in which everybody just assumed I knew what I was doing and I didn't. But by this point, I had at least one season of Dawson's Creek under my belt. So I was getting a little bit more comfortable with the process of filming and finding the lens and knowing my light and all that kind of stuff. All the weird distractions that kind of have to become second nature. So it was a really weird time. It was the first time I was experiencing not being able to walk down the street. we would go out with the football players in downtown Austin, and people would just recognize me, and it would become, and you said heady is the perfect word for it, because I was trying to wrap my head around it. What does this mean? I'm not supposed to take ego from it, right? Because that's weird. That would be weird to take ego from people saying, I love you, based on something that's totally fake that I didn't write. That's, and I was really trying to just, what does all of this mean? Voight came to play. I mean, he would mess with me off camera, you know, just up to the point where I might take it personally, but I never did. And at one point, I felt comfortable enough to ask him, how do you deal with this? How do you deal with fame? Because I remember we're shooting a scene at night, and some kid comes up to John Voight, who's been nominated for 2 Oscars, has won one. And this kid comes up to Voight and goes, hey, I know you. You're that guy from Anaconda. Which I'm sure is, you know, at the top of anybody's pride list on the resume. You know, not coming home, not Deliverance. You're that guy from Anaconda. And John goes, that's right. And the kid goes, yeah, you got eaten by the snake. John's like, yeah, I was a bad guy. And the kid goes, remember that scene where that guy says, and he starts playing the scene with John, and John starts playing the scene with him. No ego, just completely at play. And that's when I asked him, I said, how do you deal with that being recognized like that? And he said, it's very simple. He said, you're not going to take ego from it. It's not who you are. He said, you have such a gift. And that is the gift of being able to make somebody very happy by doing something very simple. All you have to do is sign that paper, give him a little bit of time, look at him, talk to him, and you'll make him happy. What a gift that is. And that made it click for me.
Why was John Voight testing you?
He came to play, man. It's a high school movie. It was MTV Films. It was Paramount, but it was, I mean, a lot of actors of his stature could easily come down for their little time that they're going to be there, phone it in, not be there for their coverage, and just, you know, he's making a teen movie. But John came in guns blazing, and we all revered him so highly. And he just wanted to create that dynamic that we could play with on camera. And then always throw me a little bit of a bone. There's that scene in at the very end where they're putting the needle in Wendell's leg, and I'm standing in the doorway. And at the time, I didn't realize what was appropriate and what was not in terms of rewriting. So there's something else that I'd wanted to say, and it was very long and probably very flowery, and it was just sounding like a speech. And in the middle of a take, John turns around and he shuts the door in my face. And it pissed me off, and I stepped forward in the door and slammed it open with my fist, and I got through the rest of the line. And they'll cut, and I'm looking at John a little bit hot, like, what the hell are you doing? And he turns to me kind of under his breath and goes, that was good, do that. And I realized, oh my God, I'm not playing with Larry Bird, I'm playing with Jason Kidd. He just threw me.
He's setting you up.
Totally set me up in the best way. But he knows how to help everybody around him and make everybody around him better. And so that was, I thought, that's the kind of actor I wanted to be.
You got a bad attitude and you don't listen. We do things around here my way. You understand that? You show me the kind of smarts, makes me wonder if you know the difference between a sneeze and a wet fart. You're going to be second string all your life, boy.
Man, Kilmer loves the bag on your boy, Sammy. Been on him all season.
I stood up to it. So will he.
But James, I think that's that old school actor who didn't look at a role and go, it's a secondary role.
Yeah.
It's a role, and I'm going to make it a great role, no matter how long it is or what it is or where it is or who I'm working with. I think it's a testament to actors of that era.
He was a great mentor to everybody. And to this day, I mean, if I had any question, there's a number for John. That's like an answering service. And if I called it, he would call me back within 24 hours from wherever he is in the world. He's just been really great.
But also, you have to stand up to him. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you have to build up the courage throughout the movie to actually stand up to John Voight. As it goes along, does it help that you get to know him more, or does it hurt it a little bit? You need a little bit more edge at the end.
I was nervous the entire time for that scene at the end. We shot at the end of shooting, and thank God we did. And the guys in that locker room were guys who were shooting the actual football with us. So it wasn't like we brought in some actors or extras to just look at. These are guys we'd been with for months. There was an energy on that movie that made it feel important. And I hate that word because nobody wants to make an important film. I mean, you know, it's a snooze fest right there. remember going up to Brian Robbins, the director, and saying, hey, man, I just want to thank you for making this movie. I'm on this movie because I had a high school coach this man broke down into tears, a grown ass man, still that traumatized by what his high school football coach had done to him. And I remember seeing that and feeling like, wow, we're really telling a story here. We're telling somebody's story. So when it came time for that scene, there was very little difference between Voight and Kilmer at that point.
I was wondering that. I didn't think so.
Yeah, he would just roll with it. In between action and cut, man, whatever happened, he would just go with it. He was very intimidating. The only thing that chipped away at the intimidating nature of him was John has a gap in his teeth that, as he put it, make him look endearing. So he wore these little fake front teeth to make them straight so that he would look more just slick and intimidating. And he was totally right. The teeth made him look intimidating. What was not intimidating was when he got really fired up and the teeth would fly out of his mouth. So you just kind of remind yourself, that's right. They're fake teeth. He's not really that scary. You can do this. He really was a gem in that he didn't play possum at all. He came at me with his A game and forced me to step up. And just the fact that he trusted me to do that gave me confidence.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
When do you know you've nailed a scene like that?
I've nailed the scene when, at the end of it, if somebody says, that was great, can you do that again? I don't really know what I did. That's the only time I feel comfortable moving on. There was a moment in the speech to everybody. You know, they're football players. They're not actors. So if it's not sincere, they're not going to throw you a bone. They're just going to look at you like, why are you acting weird? And the camera was on a dolly track, and it went right in between two heads, and I knew it was on me. And I said that last line of Let's Be Heroes. And it was the first time I was able to have seen a camera, know that I was going to be in the frame, know that it was usable, and not be distracted by it. It was all part of the dance. That was a fun moment to feel like, I think I'm starting to get this filming, this acting on camera thing.
What's the line people recite to you when they see you with Varsity Blues?
Oh, for sure. It's, I don't want your life.
You got the opportunity of a lifetime.
Playing football like at West Canaan is not the opportunity of a lifetime.
Your attitude's wrong. Your tone of voice is wrong. This is your opportunity
for you. Playing football at West Canaan may have been the opportunity of your lifetime, but I don't want your life.
How did you come up with your accent?
So the accent I figured out about halfway through shooting.
I was going to bring it up. I didn't want to be a buzzkill, but I kept thinking, you're going to sound like Matthew McConaughey at the end of this movie if you keep going this way.
Yeah. You know, they had a guy who was a really nice guy as our dialect coach. He wasn't really a dialect coach. He was just a guy from Texas. It was a little challenging at first. I also just come from North Carolina, where it's Southern, but it's very different than Texas. In the beginning, about half that movie, it was tricky. But thank God by the time we got to the locker room stuff, I felt comfortable enough in it. And it sounded good enough. A couple uneven spots throughout that movie. But, you know, I was also, again, 21. I didn't know how to learn an accent. There are techniques and there are ways to do it and ways to look at consonants after percussive and consonants. I mean, there's a whole science to it, which I've since learned, which I did not know on that movie. So.
Do you know your speech by heart from the locker room?
I could probably do most of it. Yeah. I mean, that was the one you practice kind of every night when you get back. You look at it and make sure you know it. And so for years, I thought, oh, you know, I really kind of rewrote that speech because I'm a writer now. And so I was doing that then. And I know I was doing this interview today, I found the script because we had just moved and I knew where the script was. And I looked at what I'd written and it was almost word for word what was in the script. It was barely any difference at all.
Well done, Shakespeare.
Yeah. Look, I made it a little bit different. How smart am I?
Now, do you have the script there that you marked? Did you mark it up?
I do, yeah. I have it right here in front of me, actually.
Is there anything in there that you look back and you either go, that's pretty enlightening, or that's pretty silly, or what was I thinking?
I did find him writing phonetically, I don't want your life.
Why did it have to be? Oh, you wrote it phonetically.
No, the dialect coach wrote it out phonetically. A-H, don't want, W-A-O-W-T, your, Y-E-R, life, L-A-H-F.
Your life.
Yeah, so I saw that and I just laughed. I thought that's pretty funny.
Did you laugh or did you laugh?
I laughed. You got to add another sound in there.
I think you could have channeled Brett Favre in his delivery, and you could have been okay, even though he's from Mississippi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That could be good.
How much competition within the younger actors there? The guys who are true actors, you know, Scott Kahn and Paul Walker, like the human nature is they're going to look at you and go, maybe I should be doing this, or I'm just as good. Like, I don't know if it got that way or you felt that way.
It was interesting. They wanted me for Lance. They wanted me for Paul Walker's part initially. And I said, no, Mox is my role. And they really were not interested in me playing Mox, and I had to pass on it and it went away. And then it came back, you know, being a cavalier 20-year-old at that time. This is one of those roles I knew I would really connect to, but we were all there to win. Everybody knew when each actor's big scene was up. Like for me, the big scene was the locker room. For Ron, the big scene was on the back of the pickup truck with a shotgun. And so we all looked at the schedule and we all knew when everybody's big day was. And so there was a little bit of kind of locker room, like, all right, don't mess up.
Showtime. Yeah.
What you got? You going to do it? There was some camaraderie too, because there was also like, hey, how'd it go? How did Ron do last night? I was like, oh man, he was crying. He was on the back of the pickup truck. He threw this whiskey bottle and it was the only whiskey bottle we had. And they almost blew the take because they were like, no. We were all so invested. I have a good relationship with those guys.
Before this game started, Kilmer said, 48 minutes for the next 48 years of our lives. Let's go out there and we'll play the next 24 minutes for the next 24 minutes. And we'll leave it all out on the field. We got the rest of our lives to be mediocre, but we have the opportunity to play like gods for the next half of football. But we can't be afraid to lose. There's no room for fear in this game. And we go out there and we half-ass it because we're scared. All we're left with is an excuse. We're always going to wonder. But we go out there and we give it absolutely everything. That's heroic. Let's be heroes.
When did you know you had something with this movie?
It's funny. When I was doing ADR for the movie, so sometimes, you know, if they're going to re-record dialogue, and when that happens, you watch the movie without any sound, without any music. And I'm watching scenes that were cut that to me were so important, you know, in my omniscient 21-year-old self. Was, you know, oh my God, how could they lose that scene? It's the most important scene in the movie. And I thought, oh no, what is, this movie is going to be terrible. That scene, the movie without that scene is nothing. And I actually called the Voight and I said, hey, what do I do about this? And John said, well, you know, it's your right to ask, but why don't you call the director? And I did. And the director explained why he had done certain things, but I don't think I really trusted him until I was in New York the weekend that it opened. I was hosting Saturday Night Live and Scott Kahn was in New York and we both snuck into a screening downtown. We were stuck into an opening night paying, you know, crowd in New York, and the movie killed. I mean, people laughing at all the right places, people cheering, standing on seats. I remember turning to Scott at one point going, dude, this is totally working. And he just looked at me like, yeah. It was really fun to be in the back of the theater and watch the director be 100% right and me be 100% wrong about what he had done with his movie.
Who taught you to play quarterback?
Peter Gardere, who played for UT. He played a little bit in the NFL, and he was my stunt double. And then he took the most vicious hits that you see me take in that movie are all Peter. You cut to me looking pretty, and then you cut to Peter getting the snot kicked out of him. And so he really worked with me every night. We shot football for a solid month on that movie. We would just show up around sunset. We would walk through the plays. Every single play was diagrammed. Mark Ellis, our football coordinator, did an incredible job. We would walk through what we were going to shoot that night. We'd get the cameras on the field. And we had a bunch of guys who'd played Texas high school football. A lot of them had played college. We even snuck a couple of pros in there just because we needed guys who could execute, not hit a camera. And then they needed to be able to plug us in. And we needed guys who could hit us a little bit without killing us. And so we were just on the field all night, and Peter would take me aside and we'd practice drops and looks and reads. And
but you can't fool a sports fan who's watching a sports movie.
100%. You can't fake it.
That's the first thing they look for is, does he look like a real quarterback? Does he throw like a real quarterback?
You can't fake it. I've had to learn a lot of weird things over the years, everything from horseback riding to quarterback to even work with guns and stunt fighting. You got to start with the feet. The footwork, if you don't have that, you're sunk. And so we really did. We kind of started from the ground up. And there are a couple throws in there that are mine.
Who were you out there? Who were you channeling?
My guy was Brett Favre. I just love the enthusiasm with which he played the game.
And number four.
That's why I actually requested to be number four. I think he was supposed to be something else. It was my one request when I got the job was, how can we change his number? Yeah. 21 years old. That wasn't a bigger trailer. It wasn't more money. It's like, guys, can we please have him be number four?
I think you were number 13, and then maybe they changed it to four.
I think it was 13, actually.
Yeah. So maybe it was Dan Marino, but you didn't want to be Dan Marino. You wanted to be Brett Favre.
I wanted to be Brett Favre, yeah.
And then you're selected as one of People Magazine's 50 Most Beautiful People. Other than that, not much happening here.
It was... They were crazy times. It's weird. I don't think when you get, because I would have been happy at that age being an unknown theater actor.
How did you not get caught up in it?
I think being in North Carolina helped a lot. I think shooting in Wilmington, North Carolina. I've always said, I think the problem when young people get famous is their behavior ceases to have consequence. It's like it happens in a vacuum. Whereas in North Carolina, we were shooting in a small town. And so if you were annoying on set, you were lonely on the weekends. Nobody would want to hang out with you. And I say only half jokingly that crew and that spot is the reason none of us are in jail right now. And not, I mean, just not in jail. We're all doing really, really well.
But you pin it back on that.
Yeah, it was that was the crazy time. That was the rocket ship ride. And when you have people around you who can tell you whether your behavior is cool or not, it makes a huge, huge difference. Because you're in your early 20s, so you're experimenting anyway. Most people experiment with stuff and they get blowback and think, oh, I'm not doing that again. And we had the benefit of that because of where we shot and we weren't being pulled in all these crazy directions by all these kind of vulture people that exist in LA. By the time we got to LA, we were a little more prepared for it.
The strangest reaction you've ever gotten from somebody.
Huh, from that movie?
Yeah.
Remember a mother following me out of the Harris Teeter in Wilmington, North Carolina, taking her hand, wiping dirt off the hood of my car, holding her palm up and saying, thank you, I will take this home to my children. Like, what's the kid's reaction when she gets home? She's like, hey, kids, look what I got.
Like dirt, Mom.
Are the kids excited? Are they?
Let's gather around the kitchen table.
It got really weird back in the day.
But were you different on the set of Dawson's Creek, or did they expect you to be different after all the things you had done?
You know what was weird? And this is what's weird about fame is it changes the way people around you act. Yeah. It doesn't really change you. I remember, because we were working such long hours on that. I remember season one, there was a PA named Craig, great guy. Season one, he'd say, all right, we're going to force your turnaround, meaning I only get 10 hours in between before I have to show up again at work. And I go, Craig, you're killing me. God, you know, when you force my call again. So I did that all season one. Season two came around and he said it as like, you know, we're forcing your call again. I was like, Craig, you're killing me. Come on. And his response was, no, Mr. Vanderbeek, I would never try to force you to do anything. I was like, Craig, it's me. What are you talking about? What do you mean? So there was, there were little things like that where all of a sudden people are responding differently. I had a trailer door that stuck because the little pin kept on falling out. And so the only way to get it closed was to slam it. And after about 3 days of this, I had all the executive producers in my trailer very seriously sitting me down, asking me if anything was wrong. Of course, you know you can come to us. We've heard that you've been slamming your trailer door. I was like, guys, it doesn't close. Look, and I showed them the pin. And they're like, okay. So all of a sudden your actions take on this unintended consequence. It's way bigger than, that's outsized. And so that was an adjustment.
Did you guys get in trouble going out?
Oh yeah. But you know, back then we did stuff that, I mean, it wasn't anything crazy, but it was stuff that stupid 22-year-olds do. You know, we'd do something and come back and wake up the next morning. Oh, that was stupid. I'm never doing that again. And we'd be free to never do it again.
Until the next weekend.
Until the next week. But we generally, you know, figured it out. I mean, now if somebody catches you doing something stupid on camera, then it's out there and then you're labeled as the person who did that stupid thing, who does that stupid thing. And I think there is a power to that. So anybody who's famous now, who's younger, I have so much empathy for, just because I understand what it's... how tricky it is to navigate, and it's way trickier now with social media. I thank God on an almost monthly basis that Twitter did not exist, thinking that every thought in my head needed an audience. I would have spent the last 10 years apologizing.
What role did your parents play?
My parents were really solid. My mom had been a dancer. I'd done like a couple national tours before I was born. My father had been a baseball player. So they understood what it was like to chase a dream. You know, they were just kind of very solid people. Grew up in Connecticut. I was very fortunate. I had a good foundation on which to launch into that insanity.
Yeah, because a lot of times the parents want to be along for the ride. Like they get caught up in it as well.
Yeah, thank goodness that was not the case with them. I mean, when I was 15 years old, I said to my mom, I think I can do this for real in New York. And my mom, I think her secret plan was maybe I go in, realize it's really hard, and then don't major in theater in college and pay all that money to come out with a theater degree. But as it was, I got an agent right away. And then it was a year and a half of auditioning, driving. I was in Connecticut, so it took 3 hours to get into New York, 3 hours back. For every commercial callback. And for a year and a half, I didn't get a single thing. That really, I think, created gratitude for when I did start to work. Just recognizing, wow, I'm on a set. I have a trailer. Somebody's paying me to be here. There's free food. And also just my parents' outlook, really. And the fact that they, you know, lived in a town with neighbors who also knew that I was out there in the public eye. And thinking, I don't want to do anything to make them, you know, want to draw their curtains and hide.
Thank you, James. I appreciate your time, and it's great to talk to you.
Awesome, man. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, buddy.
Thanks, Dan.
New episodes of IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick are available exclusively on Amazon Music. Please make sure to follow us in the Amazon Music app to get every episode. IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick was created, hosted, and produced by me, Dan Patrick. It's also produced by Brendan Pike, edited by Nathan Moody, and executive produced by Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood for Workhouse Media. IMDb's That Scene with Dan Patrick is a production of Dan Patrick Productions and IMDb in association with Workhouse Media.
Hey, Prime members. You can listen to That Scene with Dan Patrick ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.